A new iPhone update sends notifications to users letting them know how much time they spend on their phones in a week. It's called screen time, and even though it's responding to a plea for help with screen overload, it has not been well received. A CNN politics editor is one of the many iPhone users who tweeted her dismay. iPhone's screen time function sucks, she says. You created this world. You do not get to shame me for living in it. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. And today we're not wagging our fingers. We're looking at ourselves. What's wrong with us? Why can't we stop looking at our phones? I want to start with Ian Schur. He wrote an article about his own screen addiction and his fear that it might be hurting his 2-year-old son. It's called Your Kids Hate Your Smartphone Addiction. Ian, good morning.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good, how are you?
I'm okay. I'm talking to you from my phone, of course.
Yeah, but that means you're not looking at it.
That's true.
So what inspired this article?
You know, I have been struggling with this issue really since I can remember. I mean, when I first started dating my now wife, we had a lot of conversations about how much I was using my phone. The iPhone came out. It kind of drove that all into overload. And then my son came along 2 years ago, and the conversation kind of shifted to what kind of model do we want to present to him about how you're supposed to behave and handle these things? And are we being appropriate parents when we're looking at our phone? And I really wanted to dig into this because it's very easy to feel bad about it and just start kind of beating yourself up.
And sneaking glances, as you describe.
Sneaking glances, absolutely. Because, you know, we have this culture that's very anti-screen time. And look, I certainly have
problems.
But
also that expects you to respond to everything coming to you through your phone at all times.
Yes, exactly, right? I mean, there are a number of instances. One, probably the most egregious, sneaking a look at an alert during a religious service. But, you know, this is normal behavior for a lot of people. So I wanted to figure out, okay, how serious is this? Is there any research out there? And what I found is that there's a growing body of research that's showing that parents' phone addictions actually do hurt their kids. They make them feel unimportant, sad, mad, angry, lonely. One study that really hit me was that they actually looked at parents and caregivers who were on their phones in a fast food restaurant. So think about this. The parents and the kids are eating, so they're doing another activity. The parents pull out their phone, and the kids still bid for attention and start behaving poorly because the parents are on the phone, even though everyone's eating. So it's a problem that continues to be going on.
You cite some harrowing statistics in this article. According to a data analytics firm called Flurry, the average American spends about 5 hours a day on a mobile device. And you say that number skews even higher for young adults, that nearly 40% of people between 18 and 29 are online almost constantly, according to the Pew Research Center, and that 9 times out of 10 they're on a mobile device. This information does bother me, and we can talk about why, but it doesn't actually surprise me. Does it surprise you?
Not at all. I mean, this is part of the culture that we live in now. And if you look at it, there are efforts underway in other places to try and kind of change the culture around our phones, right? For example, in France, they actually passed a law where people are allowed to shut off their work devices, right, their work email, and they can't be penalized after work. That is something that's like alien in this country. So there are, you know, there is a kind of a culture that we built up in this country, whether we wanted to or not, where our phones are just constantly in our hands at a 45-degree angle, and we're always looking at them. And that is something that is concerning. And then it affects things like our relationships and our parenting and all these other things.
You know, it's interesting. I also have a 2-year-old, and I have a self-determined rule of not looking at my phone in front of him. And if I have a circumstance where I need to look at it, I explain to him what I'm doing so that it's not just sort of this taking mom away, like, mystery. But it's interesting that during the time I'm not looking at my phone, which is really just like after work and before his very early bedtime, it's very frustrating to the people in my life that I'm not responding to them. And that is a piece of this.
Yeah, you know, I think it's interesting. I think part of that, it depends on kind of the set expectations you set, right? And for me, you know, I have partially through my behavior, set an expectation that people know I'm ultra responsive. And I've created this hole for myself, right, where I have to be ultra responsive. And having, you know, kind of setting new boundaries is hard. But one of the things that, you know, I spoke to a lot of child development experts as part of the story for CNET. And one of the things they always told me was that I need to make sure that I'm careful about my boundaries. It can't be extreme, right? It's not fair to expect me to just quit the phone cold turkey whenever I'm around him. But if I set appropriate boundaries for him, for me, in my life, I can make it work. And I think that's what's important, right? The extremes never do.
So talk a little bit about, you talked to experts, you did two things. You talked to experts about why you couldn't just control this on your own. And then you also talked about advice for setting boundaries. Let's start with that first part. Why are we all addicts?
Well, a lot of this actually comes down to just the way our brains work. You know, when you get an alert, it kicks off this little dopamine reaction, right? Which is the same thing that causes us to seek out food and drugs and, you know, all sorts of other stuff. It leads to addictive behavior. And so dopamine actually stimulates and rewards us when it comes on an unpredictable schedule, which is exactly what phone alerts are, right? They come in all the time. So this means that there's constantly kind of your brain is being besieged by these things that it really wants. It wants these distractions. It wants these little kicks of interest. And that's part of why we all struggle with this, whether or not we're parents. And so part of what the recommendations were to make it better were actually to try and make sure that I am thinking about how am I being appropriate to my son. And what that means is stuff like, for example, if I have an alert that comes in on my phone and I have to look at it, just like you, telling him what I'm doing, explaining what I'm doing is a really good behavior, because then he doesn't think I'm just ignoring him, which, look, for a kid who doesn't understand what this metal slab in your hand is, that's really important. The other thing that was recommended by Dr. Harvey Karp, who's kind of the, you know, the Dr. Spock of our era, one of the things he recommended was that you actually set a timer. One person actually recommended I get a sand timer that's like a minute sand timer that the kid can control. And when the sand timer runs out, I have to go back to paying attention. And that way they have a sense of time and attention and patience that goes along with this whole exercise for you and me.
Well, so forgetting the impact on your child, what has been the impact on you and your own quality of life now that you have set boundaries? Is it different?
Well, to be honest, I struggle. And I even though, you know, I've written this story and I still struggle with it. And I think that it's going to be something that really this generation of parents is going to struggle with, because we grew up in this era where it was kind of, we weren't thinking about these things. And we've kind of created these addictions for ourselves for these alerts. And it's going to be a constant struggle. And what's interesting is I hear about kids today who are like 5 to 8. And a lot of them are rejecting technology the way we use it. They are trying to set boundaries because they don't like what's going on. And they're kind of reacting to how we are. So I think it's going to be a constant struggle for you and me. But, you know, it's something that I do think about a lot. And I try, you know, the big thing was Harvey Karp told me, look, don't beat yourself up. It's not fair. One of the stats that he gave me that just blew my mind is that there's this thing called the American Time Use Survey. It's something the Department of Labor has been doing for like 50 or 60 years. It's about how people use their time. And one of the stats that comes out of that is that they found that we actually spend more time just focused on parenting our kids today than housewives alone did during the 1960s. And part of that is because of a lot of things. We've isolated our families. We don't actually have as many people helping us parent as they did back 50, 60 years ago. But the result of that is that we need to be able to give ourselves a little bit of time on our own and respect that we need to do that, but also make sure we're also taking care of our kids. And that's a very hard thing to do.
Well, you know, I mean, what actually bothers me about my own phone use, and I say this in spite of other people frequently calling me a Luddite, it bothers me to think about what I am not doing instead. It's not that I feel bad about what I'm doing on my phone. It's that I remember how I used free time in the past, speaking of how we use our time. And
right.
I marvel that these little gadgets can even begin to compete with, like, baking bread. You know,
Yeah, no, totally. And, you know, I think that might be, I'm really curious to see what the generation growing up now is going to be like in 10 or 15 years, because there are always these reactions that happen. And it may be that there's a push toward that. I think also, you know, Apple and Google are not dumb. This whole screen time feature that you mentioned at the top of the show, that is something that's a reaction to a growing trend. This conversation is not happening in a vacuum. There's a lot of conversation about how much we're using our phones. And I think it started with the texting and driving conversation and our obsession with even having to do that and place ourselves in danger. Now it's moving to how is it affecting our relationships and our kids. And I think that as that continues, there's going to be a reaction. If Apple and Google don't look like they're on it, they're going to start looking like the villains in all of this.
So what do you think, would be some good advice for the companies themselves? Like, if people don't like the screen time function, what would your advice as someone who wants help be to, like, how can the companies who put these things in our hands help us regulate them so that we don't hate them eventually?
Yeah, I think that part of it is actually going to be on you and me and a lot of other people. It's how many of these alerts do we sign up for? How often are we putting ourselves in this situation where we are allowing ourselves to get these dopamine kicks? A lot of it is actually going to come from you and me. But there are things that these companies can do. One of them is to very aggressively offer tools to be able to silence these notifications, to control them, so that, you know, you say, look, you know, if I'm at home, for example, if my location, my phone notices I'm at home, don't send me notifications or stuff like that. There are all these types of features that they could offer. And look, it's on you and me to set them up and learn how they work and all of that.
But yeah, I set up the thing where my phone will not let me get a call if I'm driving. And but even if I'm in someone else's moving car, it admonishes me.
Right. And that's part of the problem is that these features are not smart enough yet. Right. And what happens is that if it doesn't work perfectly for you, you're going to give up on it, which is how all of us would feel. So that's part of where these companies really need to work and refine. But, you know, I've talked to Apple and I've talked to Google, and both of them have told me that they understand that this is something people are anxious about and they want to offer solutions. Now, you may see that as cold comfort, considering they're also selling us the drug in the first place, but at least they see the problem.
I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and we're talking about smartphone addiction. We're taking calls, offering confessions of your problems, solutions for setting boundaries. And you know who I'd also really love to hear from? People who don't use smartphones at all. How does that work for you in today's world? Ian Schur is my guest. And Ian, you wrote this article, Your Kids Hate Your Smartphone Addiction. And you know what I like about the title? It flips the conversation we usually have on its head. We talk so much about how to keep our kids from being obsessed with screens and, you know, not interested in flesh and blood humans around them. But we do not acknowledge that our own behavior is the problem.
Yeah, that is exactly why I wrote this story, is that I have been hearing since way before we had our kid about these concerns about screen time for kids. And there was never really much conversation about the adults in the room. And it felt like every time I was at a party or I was at a dinner, all the adults were on their phones and they were kind of going along. But then they'd suddenly admonish the kids, don't be on your iPad. And it's felt very weird to me. And so part of our coverage at CNET, we've really tried to look at how is this stuff changing the culture of adults using technology? And then how is that impacting kids? Because I feel like we need to remember that all of this parenting stuff is a two-way street. It's not just about how the kids are behaving. And it's a really important conversation. Mm-hmm.
Let's bring in someone who has done work on kids and screens here in Kansas City, because what works and what doesn't for kids might be worth considering for ourselves. Tracy Foster, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
You are the co-founder of a company known as START. That's an acronym for Stand Together and Rethink Technology. What is that?
Yeah, so what it is it's a grassroots movement of parents who started exactly as Ian and you are saying, by thinking, wow, I'm seeing what's happening with my kids. I'm seeing the pressures that we're getting to at earlier and earlier ages, give them devices and feel like they're going to miss out in the global society and economy if they're not constantly using devices. And we started to say, it's almost
like words with friends.
Yes, exactly. And it's almost like we just kind of fell into that. And we realized, is that really what we think life is about and what we think we want for our kids? So we started as just a conversation of saying, how do we feel about this? It was 10 parents here in Kansas City on a closed Facebook group, which we laugh at the irony of that. Yes, technology can support our values. But that closed Facebook group grew from 10 parents to over 3,000 just through word of mouth of other parents saying,
and
I'm
local,
curious
all
about
local?
This. All local. Whoa. I mean, we have a few people from other cities, but representing more than 70 schools across our metro. And so we really started looking at the child angle, but absolutely agree with exactly what Ian was sharing and you're sharing about the fact that parents come to the table because they all see the problem and challenges that their kiddos are facing. But that really, when we start to work with them, that it actually has to start with us. We're the leaders in our families.
Was there a moment in your own life that really sort of like caused that light bulb to go on for you?
Yeah, well, 7 years ago when I was pregnant with my first child, I was doing a project for work with one of the largest toy companies in the world. And as part of that, we were really reading about and understanding and hearing their beautiful perspective about the power of play and how important it is for social, emotional development, for relational connection, for cognitive development, for all sorts of things, the power of building with blocks or playing with a little farm and animals. It's actually a huge piece of development. And so I was very visibly pregnant. And after one of these meetings, their head of research pulled me aside and just said, I am so glad that you're in this meeting and hearing this, because I believe that our industry is at a moral impasse. And when I see what new parents are seeking out in the marketplace in terms of, oh, this toy comes with an app and I'm just going to get my kiddo onto the device, I just want to tell you, please, please focus on the power of play with your kid that's about to be born.
So what do you do with the schools and with parents in particular?
Yeah. So Start Right Now is working in the suburbs and is convening parents at a school level to talk about technology. And we really start by our kind of tip of the spear is saying technology with kids. But then we invite parents into a three-part conversation. So parents are committing a lot of time for busy parents to come to our session 3 different weeks for 90 minutes a week. But what we do is we pull them in and we talk to them about three things. First, we help them consider and understand what are some of the side effects that we're seeing in our community related to technology. Then we help them think about how can we create a plan to really give a roadmap of how we can work to make some of those small changes that we've been talking about. And then third, how should we think about connection and how can we make sure that we're connecting with our kids offline, but also how can we be connecting with our kids online? Because that's a reality and we don't want to be pushing ourselves out of their world in that way.
Okay, well, we're going to hear very shortly some of the specifics on this, but I want to take some of our calls. Let's talk to Marad calling us from Independence. Hi, Marad.
Hey, good morning. I really appreciate the conversation. One of my experiences is sitting in a room with my daughters and their mom, and everyone's on the phone. We're supposed to be watching a television show, a movie. And I'm saying to them, okay, you have to be able to put the phone down. So personally, I use the phone like the newspaper. So if I read the alert, I read it, I put it down. If I get messages from the news media, I read the story, I put it down. I don't allow myself to stay on it. I use an earpiece so I don't have to hold the phone. And I think that helps me from just focusing on the phone itself.
What does that allow you in your life, do you feel? I mean, does it affect other things in your life besides just phone consumption?
Well, absolutely, because I was a hands-on father, so it meant something to me to have discussions with them. If I was going to show them how to do something in the house, I actually showed them hands-on. They didn't just get the words from me, here and the instructions, here, do this. No, I would actually show them how it worked. Using the earpiece allows me the freedom to move about and do things. So if I get a call, I can still talk to you, as in now, I'm getting ready to go do something, but I can move around without holding onto that phone. But then there's the safety side of this. If you're just focusing on your phone, you're in the public, you're not really paying attention to the things around you. One of the things I would tell my children, no matter where you go, always pay attention to the route you take. So if something happens, you know how to get back home.
Yeah, and that's maybe worth a whole nother discussion. Do we still know how to navigate a place with our own brains and something that, yeah. Do we still know where we are most of the time? Maybe not. Maybe we've outsourced that to our phones. So, Ian, what are you hearing in this based on what you've talked about? Like, just this aspect of sort of that we are physically consumed by our phones, not just mentally. So like the idea of getting up and showing something. This is interesting to me because I did read an article once about how with parenting and phones specifically, our parents were also busy in front of us. But when you're interacting with the physical world, you see what they're doing. There's some transparency in it. And you're learning skills, like you're learning how to use an address book. You're learning to read the paper. Everything looks the same on a phone.
That's very true. And to a kid, especially not looking at the phone, all they see is a metal slab with glass on top that you're tapping at, right? They don't know what's going on, which is part of why the child development experts said that bringing them in and narrating what you're doing is incredibly important if you need to use a device in front of them. So, you know, and that actually has an educational aspect, right? They're learning how these things work. Eventually, they're going to want to use them on their own, and they'll have an easier time transitioning to that. So those are all very key. But the other thing I kept hearing was that this is about time management, right? It's about thinking about how much time am I spending on this device and being actively thinking about that. And I think that as people think about these things and they say, okay, I'm going to give myself, you know, I set myself a minute timer on my phone. And the minute that goes beep, I have to get off of it. Doing stuff like that and not just passively consuming it, I think changes the way that we have a relationship with this stuff and can help to kind of shape this conversation.
Let's talk to Drew in Kansas City, Kansas. Hi, Drew.
Hello. Good morning.
What do you want to share?
Well, so, I mean, I'm not necessarily the targeted demographic that you were asking for earlier. I do have a smartphone. I use it every day.
Oh, no, we're interested in your story.
Well, so I am, I guess you'd call me a millennial, and I have noticed that in my generation specifically, the effect that smartphones have had on us, it's not simply just, like the other caller said, not knowing where we are, not knowing how to get back from the route we've taken, but it's kind of what the guest that you have on spoke on earlier about the dopamine receptors and how that easily formulates an addiction. And addictive properties, as you know, a lot of psychologists have talked about, do have the capacity to create a type of psychosis, you know, where you are experiencing delusions, but now we're experiencing them in mass. So we're at the point now where we have these psychosis machines in our hands. And at least people in my generation, the way that we're coping with it is using overabundance of irony and sarcasm to denote our circumstances.
Wait. Okay, I need you to explain this a little bit more. When you say psychosis machines, in what way are we can you describe the psychosis we're experiencing en masse, as you put it?
Yes. So what I mean is we are experiencing a sense of isolation, a delusion of isolation through engagement through indirect means. So in one sense, we feel completely isolated. In the next moment, we also feel as though we're being immersed by an overabundance of information and overabundance of notifications. This kind of causes, a psychosis of sorts, not necessarily purely pathological, but in some ways it is.
Okay.
To the point where it is a constant struggle.
Let's hear Ian's response to this. Ian, this idea of being in contact but not connected.
Mm-hmm. It's actually really fascinating. You know, as I brought up, Dr. Harvey Karp, who's kind of the Dr. Spock of this generation, he's very focused on this idea of how isolated we all are. And it's something that's been coming up a lot, which is that as we are parenting, this next generation of parents and the millennials who really waited a long time to become parents because of the recession and all sorts of other things are now starting to have kids. And they're learning that they don't have as much support because they've isolated each other and they don't have the group thing. For example, you know, Dr. Karp was talking to me about how we all remember we've seen on television or we've heard the stories about the parents on Sunday morning who were reading the newspaper, right? And the kids were playing in the other room and everything was fine. A lot of us, that feels like an alien thing. We can't imagine being able to do our own thing on a Sunday. And part of the reason that was possible was not because we didn't have our phones or whatever else. It was because we had more help. Our families were more involved. We had more friends who were over more often. There were more
kids. But was that because we were not texting with them? We were actually gathering?
You know, it's actually a very hard thing to nail down. There's a lot of research going on right now to try and figure out how did we isolate each other so much? Because there's other data out there, for example, that we are actually less mobile today. We're unwilling to move for a job and stuff like that than we were 60 years ago. So you would think, well, maybe we're moving away for our families more, and that's what's doing it. But the opposite is true. So there's something going on in this culture that no one's really nailed down yet, that everyone's kind of circling, including in this conversation, trying to figure out why we've isolated each other so much. And also, as a result, why we kind of bid for the phone as a way to kind of at least get out to the real world and get away from this extra time that we're spending parenting.
This is super depressing. Tracy Foster, I want to turn back to you because, you know, the parents and families you work with, they're working with you voluntarily, mm-hmm. and they're giving of their time. They're invested in having a healthier relationship with technology. Have you thought about trying to reach a less like voluntary audience, and what do you suppose that might be like?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, we started by really thinking about gathering these parents in communities, but then what we heard from the people who we were serving was we need more. And we thought about the fact that it was essentially becoming like a little bit of a mountaintop experience just for a few, and then they were going back out into the world and not necessarily having it reinforced by others or by other venues. We and our kids have our tech norms. We talk a lot about creating new norms for our community. They're influenced by so many different things, our schools, our families, our daycare, our jobs, our everywhere we touch. So what's really powerful about here in Kansas City with those 3,000 people, and it's more now, is that it's not just about those training sessions. We believe that's kind of the mile deep, inch wide, people really getting a lot of training and equipping. But we're actually working with people across the community, municipal leaders, business leaders, education sector leaders, so many people to say, hey, this takes a village, not just the way Ian was talking about it in terms of a village of raising your kids that way, but it also takes a village to set what those norms are in a community.
So what interests me about your work thinking about schools is that you have ended up not actually advocating for banning cell phones at school altogether, which is interesting to me because that's sort of the popular rallying cry.
Well, I would say we are very supportive of schools and encourage schools to reduce bring your own devices to school. So that is something that causes a lot of tension if kids are on their own devices inside of a school using their cellular access to access who knows what and being distracted from curriculum. It's much better if the child is on a school-provided device that hopefully has solid filters and controls, which several of the school districts are actively thinking about. But it is true that we are not trying to say there's a line in the sand, you need to just withhold technology from your kids until a certain age or this or that. We compare it much more to the process of driving. So we don't take a kid and say, congratulations, you're 16, here's your present, it's car keys, go out and have fun. And try to stay safe. You know, we actually are training our kids how to handle driving in a proper way from the time that they're very young. I have 2 kids, 3 and 7, and they're asking me all the time about my driving. They're learning through the modeling of riding in the back seat, similar to what you and Ian were sharing. But then you'd have for driving that we're just lacking for technology. So right now my kids are also learning about technology. They're learning about technology by how I'm interacting with it, even though they don't have devices of their own. They're learning, what should I give my attention to? How should I handle this? How can I use devices with the narrating and things that you said? But we're also eager to start to build out an actual kind of learner's permit phase that says, what does it look like to give kids increasing levels of responsibility? Because we're not just going to do all or nothing, but how can we give them the technology equivalent of starting in a parking lot, which is a very safe place with a parent or other adult who can help train them on how to take incremental steps and grow their responsibility accordingly in a safer, more measured way?
If you were to leave us with one lesson to be learned from what works and what doesn't work for kids, like lessons mm-hmm. that we can use for our own selves, what mm-hmm. would it be?
Well, my biggest lesson of what works for kids is that we have to start by showing it with ourselves. So if we're being hypocritical about it and we're on our devices and telling our kids to get off their iPads, just like the stories earlier, I don't think it works. I think starting with us, if we were to say as a family, what should you start with? We would say the first place is, why don't you start with device-free dinners? Family meals are so important. They have so many beautiful benefits to kids' development. And so it doesn't require a gourmet meal, but just getting off of your devices together and having a conversation.
Tracy Foster, it's been great having you.
Thank you.
And Ian Schur, author of Your Kids Hate Your Smartphone Addiction, thank you, and you can check your phone now.
Thanks.
Welcome back to KCUR's Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman, and now for something else entirely. Fashion trends from the Neanderthal period. Our guest will be able to explain that better than I can. David Freyer is an anthropology professor at KU, and he's here to tell us about his discovery. Hi, David.
Good morning.
What did you discover? Tell me the story of what you saw and what it meant.
Well, this is what we found were 8 eagle talons, eagle claws, that show cut marks on them. They're dated at about 130,000 years ago from a site that was excavated between 1899 and 1905 in Croatia and Central Europe. It's a very famous site. There are lots of bones from the site, Neanderthals and animal bones and tools, etc. And the person that excavated the site was very careful, and so we're pretty sure where these came from. There are only Neanderthals found at the site, and there are 8 talons and also a finger bone, if you call that in a bird, but a bone right behind the talon called a phalanx that show, I think there are 21 cut marks on that particular bone.
So set the scene for me. Where are you when you discover this? Take me through it as though I am you.
Okay, well, to go to the beginning, I've been working at the site on the human bones and teeth for a long time. And I work with a colleague there named Jakub Radovčić, and he has a daughter, who took over his position as the curator, and as she did of the collections.
A collection in Croatia?
In Zagreb, yeah, which is the capital of Croatia. And when she went through the collections, she found these eagle talons, and she emailed me and said, I found these, and I couldn't believe it because the person that excavated the site found a lot of animal and human bones with cut marks on them, and he described cut marks and cannibalism, etc. But for some reason, he missed these completely, and he was a very thorough scientist. So I went there a little more than a year ago and looked at them and almost fell off my chair.
Why?
Well, because you don't expect this with Neanderthals.
Why not?
Well, yeah, that's a good question, why not? Because as more work is done, there's more evidence that Neanderthals are doing this. But most people think of Neanderthals as stumbling, mumbling, bumbling fools, you know, that weren't able to really find the cave at night that they slept in the night before.
Well, yeah, I mean, people say Neanderthal sort of figuratively, like, what are you, some kind of Neanderthal?
Yeah.
Like, that's what they mean. But what is it, when you see cut marks on an eagle talon, what does that mean to you? Because to me, that doesn't have great significance on its own.
Well, the cut marks are associated with disarticulation, with removing the talons, the claws from the foot. One thing I left out was that we have at least 3 different eagles because the same talon is repeated 3 times. So we're not sure how they were capturing these, probably not from corpses, but probably they were catching them somehow. But the cut marks are associated with removing the claws, but they also are eroded, and we think that they were wrapped into some kind of, probably some kind of a necklace or a bracelet. The other thing about the talons, if you think of your fingers, they show that they were rubbed on the sides of the fingers, not on the claw part, not on the palmar part, but on the sides of the claws, which suggests that they were being rubbed together, or they jostled together as they were assembled into a necklace.
So did we not think before that Neanderthals adorned themselves with jewelry, or did we not think before that Neanderthals had the sort of technical or intellectual or whatever kind of capacity to remove a talon from an eagle? Or is it some combination of the two?
It's both. Like we said, people are thought that Neanderthals were not capable of appreciating this kind of jewelry. The other thing that's important about the site is that there are eagle talons found at other Neanderthal sites in Europe, but only seven. And we found at Crapina eight, so there are more at this one site found together. And at the seven that are found at all are all in different levels and probably were pendants, certainly not in the form of some kind of jewelry that's found.
What's going through your mind as you're making these discoveries, which it's interesting because we think of these kinds of discoveries as happening out in a field somewhere digging up remains, but not necessarily within collections, sort of things that have been dug up that people have seen but failed to see meaning in them, perhaps.
Yeah, well, like I said, the guy that excavated the site was interested in cut marks on bones, so we're really surprised that he missed them. And you asked me what my feelings were. I was stunned when I saw them. I almost fell off my chair because they were so clearly modified by humans. And the more we studied them, the more it was clear that they were assembled in some kind of a jewelry item. The other thing is that the person that did it she's a friend of mine, but I knew her as a little kid. We used to pick her up at kindergarten and take her to a bar, and she would play outside, and we'd drink beer and talk about anthropology. So I've known this woman for almost 30 years, and it was really a great feeling for me that she was able to find stuff in the collections that her father couldn't find. And the material was sitting behind me, less than 5 feet away, and I never paid any attention to it. Of course, I was working on the teeth and the skulls. But
never let them tell you that bringing a kid to a bar doesn't have possible positive outcomes.
She says she spent half her life running around in front of the bar. We went there when I was just back there a few weeks ago, and we were laughing about it. So
the pendants on these early necklaces are eagle talons, as you mentioned. Does this tell us anything we didn't already know about the relationships between humans and other animals, eagles in particular, during this time period?
Well, it's odd that there aren't a lot of eagle talons that are found in the modern Homo sapiens populations until much later in time. The fact that we found eight of them suggests that Neanderthals had the ability to put them together into some kind of an assemblage, a jewelry item. Why they got lost? There's a hearth at this top level, and there are cave bear remains, and the eagle talons are not burned. We think there might be some red ochre on them, some colorant on them, and we also have evidence of fiber, we think. That's the next part of the analysis that we're doing. It could be pieces of feather. We don't know for sure.
Do you think that it's purely aesthetic, what was happening with these talons, or do you think that there might have been some function or meaning that we just have not deduced yet?
Well, the tips of the talons are not broken. They're a little bit eroded, but they're not broken. And there's no evidence that they were using them as a borer or to drill holes or anything. All of the evidence is at the other end, not from the pointed end of the talons, but at where they articulated with the bones of the foot, suggesting that they were tied together and with some kind of fiber, or maybe sinew or something. So I don't think there's any evidence of any of the other talons at other sites that were used as tools. And the irony of this is that if this was a discovery that was found associated with modern Homo sapiens, everybody would say, oh yeah, it's a necklace. Everybody would think that it was a part of an aesthetic assemblage that a modern Homo sapiens put together. But in fact, it was when it's found in Neanderthals, people say, I don't know.
Do you think of having an aesthetic as being some kind of a measure of intelligence? Because you were saying before that this is surprising because of that people think of Neanderthals as maybe having been a bit bumbling and that kind of thing. So do you see that as a measure, like, from an evolutionary standpoint?
Well, to tell you the truth, it wasn't surprising to me. It was surprising to some of the others in the field that think of Neanderthals as the Geico Neanderthal and not a Neanderthal that has modern-like abilities. They were burying their dead. They were putting offerings in some of the graves. There's another site in Italy where they were cutting off the ends of bones of the wings, probably to harvest feathers. We know that they were using colorants. So there's a lot of evidence that Neanderthals had some level of sophistication. Maybe not as much as we associate with cave paintings and stuff, although there's even some cave painting now of Neanderthals, but never to the beauty of bison, you know, running across the cave walls. But still, there's some rudimentary knowledge, and that Neanderthals were involved in aesthetics. And I think as more work is done, more careful work is done, new excavations, going back through old collections, more and more evidence will materialize that Neanderthals weren't those stumbling, mumbling, bumbling fools, but they actually had a lot of shared abilities with us. And we know that they were interbreeding with modern humans because we have some unique Neanderthal genes in us. So the view...
So we're a little bit Neanderthal?
A little bit. 2% to 4%.
All right.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and the genes are not necessarily bad genes either. I mean, you know, there are good genes associated with some of the unique Neanderthal features. And nobody would have predicted that 20 years ago. Everybody thought Neanderthals were extinct side branches with nothing to do with modern humans and shared no modern human capabilities. So there's been a real paleontological discrimination against Neanderthals since they were found.
For a very long time.
Yeah, yeah, for 150 years, yeah.
Do you have a theory on why they wore necklaces?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think they were wearing them to make themselves more attractive, either as a man or as a woman. I mean, we don't know who was wearing them. We know from other sites that they were, like I said, were collecting feathers and probably using them in their hair or whatever. So, I mean, it's easy for paleoanthropologists to run amok and tell all kinds of stories called just-so stories. But
what do you mean by that, a just-so story?
Well, it's just so, it's just so true, and, you know, maybe it's really not true, and it's something you can't ever prove, but you can just speculate on. But what we concentrated in our article was that this appeared to be jewelry and that somebody wore it and only Neanderthals are at the site. And so the cave bearers weren't wearing them. The talons are definitely modified by stone tools that they were cut, and then they appeared to be wrapped. And so,
do you think these items would be popular today?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I should have brought a colleague of mine who's a photographer there has been making T-shirts with talons all in a necklace. They would definitely be popular. And I've been in contact with people in Oklahoma that have raise eagles for their feathers, Native Americans, Comanches. And they were really excited to hear about their Neanderthal cousins having an appreciation for eagles just like they do.
When you see people in jewelry or even possibly put on jewelry yourself, do you see it in a different light, knowing how far back this practice goes?
Oh, not really. I mean, you know, you're not. Are you wearing any jewelry? You're not wearing
a small amount.
Oh, okay. Well,
I mean, for example, like I am wearing a wedding ring, and that is a piece of jewelry that carries specific meaning and fills also a social function. And I guess I wonder about how, to what extent jewelry can be functional in that sense. Not functional perhaps as like a tool that you would use to dig, but functional as something that identifies you in a certain way.
Well, you know, that's a very good observation. These eagle claws weren't easy to get. So, and there are at least three different, these are white-tailed eagles. These are the sea, if you do crossword puzzles, these are the erns, E-R-Ns, the sea eagles, that are there's no sea right there, but they are throughout Central and Western Europe. And they're the top aerial predator in the environment today and also in the past. So there's no bigger predatory bird. They're not easy to catch, and so you have at least three, maybe four different eagles that were caught, and they must have conveyed some sort of power to the person that was wearing them, or conveyed some sort of status for the person that was wearing them. I'm sure it just wasn't, they weren't just worn by anybody. They just because of the difficulty of getting the birds.
Yeah, how hard, I mean, that it does sound very hard to me, but I've never tried to catch an eagle.
I wouldn't try. I've had birder friends who I've said, have you ever seen a dead eagle in the field, in the forest? And they say, no. It's possible to catch them by digging a pit like Native Americans did and putting some meat up, and then the eagle comes down and you grab the feet of the eagle and hold on for dear life until you kill the eagle. We don't know how they were acquiring them. We assume that they were catching them. They almost for sure, I can say for sure, were not raising them. There's no domesticated animals or anything. We know that they were proficient hunters. There are big animals and small animals at this site, rhinos at this site, and small animals, deer, etc. So they were very good hunters, and they got them somehow, and then they preserved them into this necklace.
Have you always focused on the Neanderthal period?
I started off working with the people that followed Neanderthals, studied their teeth, etc., and traveled around Europe for years doing it. But then I got interested in the site in Croatia and became really good friends with the curator there and worked on toothpick grooves in these Neanderthals. They have grooves in between their teeth where they're using toothpicks to clean their teeth. And I've been lately I'm still doing it, working on scratch patterns that are on the front teeth, the incisors, upper and lower.
Why are you interested in those things? What do they mean to you?
Well, the scratch patterns, when they're oblique, can tell us something about whether they were right-handed or left-handed. If you imagine holding something in your left hand and pulling it and cutting it with a stone tool, every now and then you might hit your incisors and leave a scratch.
But just, I don't mean to sound glib, but why do we care whether they're right-handed or left-handed?
Well, modern humans are 9-to-1, right to left. And people correlate that with language, because it's on the left side, and the left side controls the right side of the body, and there's a weak correlation there. And it's associated with lateralization of the brain. And so this is a feature that's unique among all humans. That's 9-to-1 ratio, no matter where they are. They're always, it's 8-to-2, 9-to-1, something in there. And we've studied a bunch of Neanderthals now from the site in Croatia and other places, and that ratio is also about 9-to-1. So they're like us in that. Plus, we know that they had some genes that modern humans have that are associated with language. It's called the FOXP2 gene. It's complicated, but if we look at chimpanzees are closer to 50-50 in terms of left-to-right preference. Of course, they don't use stone tools in their mouths to cut objects, but still, the 9-to-1 ratio is an important signifier of humanity, and Neanderthals have that same ratio.
How did you first get interested enough to make a career out of it in the behaviors and artifacts, sort of puzzling out the artifacts of our ancient human ancestors?
Well, like I say, I first studied the evolution of the dentition in upper, what's called Upper Paleolithic and Mesolithic Europe.
But you had to already be interested by then.
Well, yeah, I was in graduate school and I took courses in fossil humans and in archaeology and in bone identification, and so I was interested in it because of that. There was some possibility of going to study the transition from hunter-gatherer to agriculture in the southeastern United States. And my advisor at the time at the University of Michigan said, you know, they have a lot of material in Europe. Maybe you should go there for the summer and study them. And it seemed to me like it was more interesting to spend my time in Europe than in Alabama or Mississippi. So
that's a good reason.
So I sort of scrapped that project and I went to Europe for the first time in 1973. God, that's a long time ago. And then I've been going back every year once for long periods of time. And
do you have a question about the Neanderthal jewelry that really weighs on you?
Well, we have a piece of fiber now that under calcite on one of the cut marks that we're going to go back and try to figure out what that is.
David Fowler, thanks so much for joining us from KU's Anthropology Department, and congratulations on your big discovery that Neanderthals wore jewelry.
Great, thank you.
To listen back to this encore presentation or any favorite shows you've heard on Central Standard, just go to kcur.org/centralstandard. Sign up for our podcast while you're there and stay current on our news by following us on Twitter. We are @KCUR CST.